As most Iowa high school students return to classes in the coming weeks, what will they learn about being a good citizen? River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer. Every year, three teachers are selected for the American Civic Education Teacher Awards. This year, they include Iowan Nancy Peterson, who teaches social studies at Gilbert High School. She will be my guest to describe what her classroom looks like and what students do. In the second half of the program, Iowa high school football practices have already started, and we'll talk about new technology for assessing concussions. We'll talk with a coach and a medical doctor. Academics and athletics, a back-to-school program after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton, in for Ben Kiefer. Well, students are back to classes soon. What does today's social studies classroom look like? What do students learn? What do they do? And how have things changed in the classroom? That's our subject for this half hour. Later in the program, we'll talk about injuries in high school athletes, especially concussions. There's a coach in Northwest Iowa using an iPad app to assess concussions. And we'll talk with a medical doctor about what's happening in the brain of a person with a concussion. But first, social studies. Every year, three teachers are recognized for their efforts preparing young people to become informed and engaged citizens. It's called the American Civic Education Teacher Award. That award is sponsored by the Center on Congress at Indiana University, the Center for Civic Education, and the National Education Association. This year, it was given to teachers from New Hampshire, Florida, and Iowa. Nancy Peterson is a social studies teacher at Gilbert High School and recipient of the 2013 American Civic Education Teacher Award. She joins us at our studio in Ames. Nancy Peterson, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for asking me, Ben.
Of course. Glad to have you on the program. We're going to have you describe what your classroom looks like, what happens, what your goals are. But first, let's talk about this award just a little bit. I understand you were asked to apply for it.
Yeah, I got an email last winter asking me to apply for it. So I went through the application process and asked three of my colleagues to write letters of recommendations that were sealed. So I have no idea what they wrote, and it must have been something nice, which is good. And then they called me at the end of June and told me that I had won this award.
And how did that feel when you realized that you'd won?
It was overwhelming, awesome feeling. I happened to be out to eat, and I couldn't, start crying or anything, because I'm sure the patrons in the restaurant would have wanted to know what was going on. But it's just... it's a great feeling when someone pats you on the back for doing a good job.
Well, let's find a little bit more about what it is that was recognized. Can you describe your classroom? What happens? Can we just take us through a day in the life of a student in one of your social studies classes?
Well, I try to get them engaged as much as possible. I also challenge them to think for themselves. I want them to think based on the facts, and I want them to challenge each other. We also, when I grew up, I was a child that liked to imagine. And so in my classroom, I asked the students to imagine. And for some, they enjoy that, and for some, it's like pulling teeth. But they get with the program. We role play. We have a debate based on the facts. I put them in groups and challenge them with a question that really doesn't have a defined answer. So I try to engage the students as much as I possibly can.
You described a little bit about your own classroom experience, and I know that learning wasn't always such a straightforward thing for you. What was your experience like?
It was not. And growing up, it just seemed like the teacher and myself were not on the same page, so I thought there was something wrong with me. The only reason why I went to college is because I had great parents who were bound to determine that I was going to go to college and I was going to get a degree in something. And they stayed with me when I went to 5 colleges and had 5 majors and took 7 years to get a 4-year degree in teaching. But I feel that this is my fit. I'm in the doing what I need to be doing. It wasn't until a few years ago that I took a class. It was called Teaching with Style, and it sounded like a good class because, you know, everyone wants to teach with style.
That's right.
And I learned that there are different styles of learning, and it opened my eyes to an amazing world that I realized that I could learn. It's just that the teacher was teaching in a different approach, and we were not connecting. So as soon as I realized that, I started taking as many classes as possible on learning styles.
But once you were actually in the classroom, how did that manifest itself, having had that experience and then wanting students, I assume you wanted them to not have to go through what you had gone through?
Right, exactly. And, you know, the because of my learning style, I'm a bit random. Those students who were very sequential, sat in the front row, raised their hand, participated. I drove those good students, so-called good students, crazy, and I couldn't understand until I took the learning style class and realized that I wasn't meeting their needs. And so being just aware of the different learning styles, being able to recognize it in students, and then varying my approach to all of my lessons, I feel that I am doing a better job of meeting the needs of all students in my classroom.
Again, we're talking with Nancy Peterson, a social studies teacher at Gilbert High School and recipient of a 2013 American Civic Education Teacher Award. And I don't know that I said congratulations on that award.
Thank you, Ben.
Well, going back to challenging students in the classroom, having students challenge each other, how do you get students to challenge each other? What does that mean?
Well, I try to come up with questions that there isn't a correct answer. They are debatable. And then I put them in groups, and we talk about how everyone's opinion is respected. You may agree to disagree, but you don't put each other down. And then they throw out their opinions. You know, asking kids to have an opinion on something, not just regurgitate what you have taught them, but to actually form an opinion based on the information that they just learned. That's what I mean by engaging them.
Specifically in social studies, as we're trying to prepare, one of the goals I hear teachers talk about is to get students to, when they leave school, be good citizens, to be engaged in the community and involved and having those critical thinking skills that you're talking about. But in doing that and even using opinions in the classroom, how do you as a teacher separate what your own opinions might be and so that you're not just teaching them your opinions, but separating them? How does that happen?
I do not want them to know what who I voted for or what my opinion is. I am very well aware of that, and I try very hard to make sure that I'm not influencing them. You know, just like learning styles, everyone views the world differently based on their life experiences. And so you may have, that's the reason why we have political parties. We will never see eye to eye on anything because we have different life lessons. And that's what I tell the students. And, you know, they try to figure out what political party that I'm affiliated with. And probably the best compliment that happened was the kids were trying to figure out what it was. And I said, okay, I'll tell you on the very last day of class. And then I made them guess. And I had both sides guessing. They had me as a Democrat. They had me as a Republican. And that's what I wanted. I don't want to influence them. I want them to think for themselves. And I constantly tell them to think for themselves. I want them to vote. And I write that when I go to their graduation parties, I write that next to my name when I sign in to their guest book. You know, you can ask any of the graduates that I've attended their party. They'll show you where I say remember to vote. But they also know that remembering to vote means to be engaged, to understand what the issues are, and be an enlightened voter.
We want to hear from listeners. Did your social studies experience influence the type of citizen you are today? How did social studies affect you? Did you take something away? Maybe not. Maybe something was missing. What was it, if so? You can call us 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Post on our Facebook page or send a tweet at IPR Talk. Joining us on the program now is Amber Graber, Social Studies and Advanced Placement Coordinator at Des Moines Public Schools. She joins us at our Des Moines studio. Amber Graber, thank you for coming in.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
What is the point of social studies in Des Moines schools?
In the Des Moines Public Schools, we feel strongly that we want all of our students to leave our school system and participate in a meaningful way, being educated, informed, and active in their citizenry. And we do that by coming together as a group of professionals to create curriculum for each grade level. And the teachers I work with have been fantastic. The way that we've done this is to use less of the traditional experience of social studies that many listeners might remember. Read this section of the text, answer these questions, find this location on a map. And we've decided to do much more analyzing of primary and secondary sources, asking students to examine very critical issues like scarcity, globalization, environmental impact, ethnic and religious conflict, have deliberative discussions over these issues, and then also participate in simulations like mock Congress, moot courts, mock elections, which our school district partners with the Polk County Auditor's Office to do. We feel really strongly we want students to participate in the classroom, and by doing so, we'll energize them to participate in their community.
And what you're describing is a little of what Nancy Peterson was also hinting at, doing some role-playing in the classroom.
Very much so. I was listening to Nancy and not only intrigued, but also felt like a partner and ally with her and Gilbert. We really want students to grapple with authentic issues so they feel that their time in the classroom is relevant. And so we feel strongly that we're compelled to do that and that we feel like it's a priority for us.
Well, again, we want to hear from you, 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100. Let's see if we can go to Susan. Susan's calling us from Cedar Rapids. Susan, go ahead.
Hi, how are you?
Just fine.
Good. My experience has been that I've been involved in politics since I was 12 years old, and I worked for John Culver, doing door-to-door canvassing, dropping off leaflets and that kind of thing. But I think that civics classes and social studies and all those kinds of things are extremely important because it helps you understand your place in the world and our place as a nation and that kind of thing. And I think it's really important. So
and
I always enjoyed that.
You feel that you've gotten critical thinking skills out of that too? Something we've heard our guests talk about a little bit?
Sure, uh-huh.
Okay, Susan, thank you for the call. Thank you for sharing. Appreciate
that. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And, Amber Graber, you wanted to follow up there?
Yeah, the caller mentions, the importance of social studies education. And as we've seen in the last 10 years, we've seen a decrease in social studies education or the importance of civic education, sometimes with an overemphasis on reading and writing and mathematical skills due to the testing environment that we live in. And I think that social studies is one of the wonderful ways that we can teach literacy, a way that we can give kids an opportunity to read and think and write about issues that are so important to them that if we brought back more social studies education into our schools and spent more time looking at these issues, we'd have a better citizenry and hopefully a better democracy.
Well, Amber Graber and also Nancy Peterson, stay with us. We're going to add one more voice to the conversation. Joining us now, Chad Tim is an associate professor of education at Grandview University in Des Moines. Among other efforts, he teaches people that are planning to become social studies teacher, and he also mentors student teachers. Chad Tim, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Of course. Well, what do you try to get social studies teachers to do? What is your training of those teachers involve?
Well, I think personally, my hope is that we add a level of complexity to the social studies conversation. I mean, historically, we've really been content-focused in social studies classrooms, and that's important. Content, we can't have anything in social studies without content. But as we prepare our students to be successful in a globalizing world in the 21st century, they need to also master the process and the skill-based arenas in social studies. And so what I hope that the young people that I teach to be teachers are doing is that they're challenging their students to make real-world connections between the content that they're learning in the classroom and their own lived experiences outside of school.
And is that what you see as maybe a motivation for teachers? What motivates teachers in this field? Is it that, or is there more to it?
Well, I think what motivates social studies teachers is the fact that as a social studies teacher, you have an opportunity to engage with your students in the world that they live in outside the classroom on a more regular basis. So, I also teach other content areas, kids who undergraduates that want to be math or science or language arts teachers and so on and so forth. And in all of my methods courses, I challenge my students to constantly make real-world connections to the content. So in every lesson that they write, in every lesson that they teach, how is the student going to interact with this content, whether it's math or science or physics or whatever it happens to be, in their life outside of school? And for a social studies teacher, we can do that on a daily basis. We can do that on a minute-by-minute basis where we're constantly challenging our students to take the content that we're learning, whether it's economics or sociology or political science, and to apply that to the world that they're living in on a daily basis. And that really, I think it inspires the students to take their learning outside of the classroom and to put it to work. And it also inspires the teachers because we see our kids get excited about it.
That's right. Well, let's go to a few more calls here. Let's see if we can go to Craig in Cedar Rapids. Craig, go ahead.
Hi. You know, our country could be functioning at a higher level instead of being so divided and we win and you lose. We could be communicating, collaborating, seeking consensus, but we just don't seem to want to function that way. We always join sides. We're ever learning and never coming to the knowledge of the truth about anything, and the truth will set you free.
Okay.
It's all about power, money, and votes, and everything becomes politicized, and we don't get the best results.
That's right, Craig. Thank you for the call. We appreciate that.
And Ben, can I weigh
in
on that?
Go ahead. Jump in. Go ahead, Nancy Peterson.
This is what I love about social studies. So I go back to the caller and I said, okay, whose truth is going to set you free? You know, because there are different sides to the coin, because people do not see things in the same way. You know, you have a glass of water sitting on your table. Is it half full or is it half empty? And so that's what we challenge the students to do in social studies, is to learn all you can and then to think what would be best, come to a solution, just like they do in math classes.
And I'm guessing Nancy feels the same way, that oftentimes we say to our students, we want you to be better than we are. What you see on cable news with people yelling back and forth and screaming at one another, screaming over the top of one another, that's not what really gets democracy done. What really gets democracy done are deliberative discussions by people that are either elected or appointed representatives who have to sit down and, at the end of the day, come to a compromise or find a solution for the people that they serve. And so we say to our students, we want you to be better than what you see. So we're going to teach you how.
Exactly.
And Chad Tim, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I respect and appreciate the caller's sentiments, and one of the historical struggles in a social studies classroom is that when we focus so much on factual-based recall and memorization, we teach our students to think very dichotomously. We teach them to think in terms of right and wrong all the time. And what effective social studies teachers do is what Nancy described to you. They teach students to think about things in ways they've never thought about them before, to take an idea and to tear it apart, put it upside down on its ear, look at it from a different angle, and put it back together again in a way that represents a new understanding. If we go to the places where we know we're going to get the answers that we're comfortable with, then we're really not learning. We're just being indoctrinated. And so we all need to, as adults, as citizens, do the same thing that we're asking our students to do, which is to challenge ourselves to think about things in new ways as often as we possibly can.
Ben, let me jump
in here. Nancy Peterson, go ahead.
With the state of Iowa participated in a consortium with 21 other states where together they wrote it's called the three C framework, and it's about concepts in social studies. It's not like what Chad was talking about. No longer is it a memorization of dates and people. It's the understanding of the social studies concepts. And you it's across the board. It's in geography and economics and history and civics. And Iowa is at the we're getting ready to unveil it, but it needs to be adopted, and I hope it is adopted. I was one of two teachers in Iowa that served on an advisory board, and I'm very pleased with it. But it's teaching the concepts, and you have to understand the stories and or the Constitution or economic principles in order for you to see and understand the concept.
Quickly, we're going to run out of time in just a minute, but I hope we could give just a quick another example of something specific that's happening in social studies classrooms that is helping students get to that point that you're talking about. Nancy, go ahead.
An example would be in my world history class. We put Napoleon on trial, and I have all of the students research 10 of the witnesses, and then the day before the trial takes place, the students draw out of a hat to see what role they will play, and then you're either going to be a lawyer for Europe or a lawyer for Napoleon, or you're going to be on the jury, or you're going to be one of the witnesses. And the whole point of this trial is to show you that there are two sides to Napoleon. People could argue that he was a good leader, but they could also argue that he was a crazy leader. And so that's an approach to, you know, I have no idea how that trial is going to turn out.
And Amber Graber, do you have a quick example?
Sure. We partner with the George Lucas Educational Foundation, and our students participate in government in a mock election so they can participate as candidates, political party leaders, interest group leaders, or members of the media. And so they simulate that election every fall.
And quickly, before we end this half hour, let's go quickly to a phone call. Carlisle calling from Des Moines. Carlisle, are you there?
Well, this is Carla from Des Moines.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Carla.
That's okay. I had the best social studies teacher in the country, and that was Mrs. P herself when I graduated from Gilbert, and my little brother Ryan did too. He's serving in the military now, and I work in agriculture, but I think that Mrs. P instilled in us a passion for all the things that she's talking about. And even though our careers are not related directly to social studies, his is in geography, a lot of classes that she taught. But, you know, I think we understand the civic community and who we are as citizens better because of our experience with her.
Hi, Carla.
Hi.
Well, thank you very much for that phone call. I'm glad you were influenced positively. Thank you for the call. We appreciate that. And well, that is going to end our program. I want to thank Nancy Peterson, social studies teacher at Gilbert High School and recipient of the 2013 American Civic Education Teacher Award. Thank you for coming in.
Thanks, Ben.
Amber Graber is social studies and advanced placement coordinator at Des Moines Public Schools. Thank you, Amber.
Thank you.
And Chad Tim, associate professor of education at Grandview University in Des Moines. Thank you for coming in to talk with us today.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up next, we'll be talking about injuries in high school athletes, especially concussions. There's a coach in Northwest Iowa using an iPad app to assess that injury. We'll be talking also with a medical doctor about what's happening in the brain of a person with a concussion. That's coming up next on River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Stanton in for Ben Kiefer. Well, it's a back-to-school show today. The first half hour we talked about social studies. Now we're going to move on to a little bit about athletics, in particular injuries. High school football practices have started for many teams across Iowa, and one concern many parents have is injuries like concussions. A couple of years ago, some new rules were put in place that aimed for better oversight by coaches and officials, and now one Iowa football coach is using an iPad to help with assessing concussion injuries, and to determine an athlete's readiness to return to practices and games. The C3 app was developed at the Cleveland Clinic in Ohio. It's being used in that state, in many high schools, and several colleges. In a few minutes, we'll be joined by a medical doctor that will also be talking about what's happening in the brain of a person with a concussion. We also want to hear from you. How dangerous are high school sports? What are your concerns? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Email river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Post on our Facebook page. Send a tweet at IPR Talk. Joining us now is the coach in Northwest Iowa that is using this iPad app. Corey Brandt is the head high school football coach for Boyden Hole Rock Valley. And he joins us over the phone. Corey Brandt, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Glad to have you on the program. Well, you've started football practice. You've done this initial baseline assessment on athletes. What did that involve? What did you do?
Well, it involved checking in kids as they came in for our equipment handout and testing day. And after that, they go into a room where they go through a series of steps of asking questions or answering questions with a moderator. And after that, they have to do a balance test on the floor and a balance test on a cushion with eyes open and eyes closed that tests their balance. And then after that, they go back out and do a series of tests, almost like a video game, I call it, where they sit down and have to finish up the process themselves. And then when they're all finished with that, they're completed. It takes about 15 minutes to do. And hopefully it's going to give us a better baseline assessment of what their brain is like when it's does not have a concussion, so we can use that for comparison later if something does happen.
And how will you use it then later? When and where will it be used?
Well, if a young man goes out there and in the football game and gets a hit to the head or in some way, shape, or form, and we're worried in any way about a concussion, the first thing we do is we have a trainer on the sideline. We do not assess kids as coaches anymore. That's the last thing I want to be thinking about when I'm trying to coach a football game is the health and safety of a kid once he's hurt. I want to turn that over to medical professional people. And we've got a trainer on the sideline that's going to take him over, and he can ask him a series of questions that they actually do have on the app along with his normal assessment that he does. And it's a really important tool for documentation. You can right away get an assessment of things that are red flags or warning signs, and that just can be used by people later if we have to further the person along with any type of treatment. But after that person is assessed initially, then they will take the full test at a later date, maybe the next day or whenever they can do it without too much like headache or problems or anything like that, and they can do that assessment, and then the doctor can read that and get a baseline. They can compare him to where he was before and hopefully tell a little bit about what part of the brain is actually hurting, what they could do to help with the treatment, maybe physical therapy with that, and then make sure that the brain is completely back to the normal baseline before they are allowed to be cleared for play again.
And, well, this technology is new, but assessing the readiness to return to a game or practice after injury, that's not new. So how is this app different than and the sort of assessments you were doing before?
Well, I kind of put it back to the old time saying, and this is the one that the guy from the Cleveland Clinic used, but the old time assessment and standard rule for a concussion was a week and pray. And then if you went back and it wasn't good, you go back and it's another week and pray harder. It was kind of like that. The old time assessment was just time. This assessment takes a look, and you get a look exactly at what part of the brain is the one that still needs recovery time, because it breaks it down into different parts with the cognitive and then the actual balance, the movement, the physical. And so you can get a better assessment on which part is actually not doing well, and you possibly can help with physical therapy on that part or something of that nature to further the child along, and then it just gives us a better objective way to look at when they're ready to come back. And hopefully that's safer for kids and their brains.
Well, Corey Brandt, you've been a coach for quite decades. When did you first hear about concussions being a concern? Do you remember when that first came about?
You know, they've always been a concern. They're something you always took, you know, seriously. But, you know, in the last 5 years, I'd say it's really become the buzzword within sports injuries, you could say. And that's just because we have a greater knowledge of what goes on in the brain. And, you know, one concussion is bad enough, but if you send a kid back too early, two concussions in a row can cause serious damage. We know that now. We didn't really know that. We didn't have enough study maybe done back when I was playing, for example. And, you know, the coaches look at you, are you all right? You know, how many fingers do I have and everything? And, yeah, you just played through a lot of things, and we know now that isn't the right way to do it. So I'd say in the last 5 years, it's kind of become the buzzword, you could say, of you know, sports. And it's something that we really want to take seriously because these are young kids playing sports, and we want to protect them for the rest of their life.
Well, and there are new rules about what coaching staff and officials have to do. What are they? How have they worked?
Well, the main rule is this. We don't, as a coach, if you've got any child with any concussions-like symptom, they're out. They're done. I mean, you used to, you know, send them in. I can't send them back in. A trainer or some health professional has to be one that says, no, they're okay, they can go back in. I, as a coach, if I have any child that's in danger in any way, shape, or form, has any concussion signs, I hold them out. We're not going to put them back in. We're not going to risk that in any way, shape, or form without him being assessed by a medical professional. If the trainer is there and they can run the assessments and things look okay, that's a different story. But we as coaches don't do that anymore, which is a good move. And the other thing is, before they can come back to play, let's say they have had a concussion, they have to be cleared by a medical professional. We can't just say, well, you've waited a week and now you can come back. They have to be cleared by a medical professional before they can come back in and be allowed to play.
Well, and Corey Brandt, I know you're using this new technology, this iPad app, and you'll assess you're assessing your athletes now with, you know, to use it later if need be. I know you don't want to have to use it later.
No.
I know you don't want your players to be injured, but it does happen. How common is a concussion injury?
You know, we've got about 100 kids out for football. And last year, I think we had 4 concussions, if I remember right. And so that's probably about a 3 to 4 average a year is probably where we're at. You would like to see less than that. We're trying to do everything that we can in our power to prevent concussions. We want their heads up when they hit. We don't want to take the head out of football as much as possible, but they do happen. And so whenever we get them to, have them happen, we just want to take care of kids as well as we can.
And talk a little bit more about prevention. How do you encourage that form and technique, and what's involved with preventing concussions?
Well, every day in practice, we do a series of drills, and you'll do your tackling drills, your blocking drills, whatever, but, you know, it's heads-up football. We don't want them using the head. We want the head up, and we want them to see what they're hitting at all times, not using the head as a battering ram or some type of bludgeoning force type thing, because that just doesn't work. So we want them to use great form and great techniques, so we're going to drill that into them every day. And when we see it, like, you know, on the film and things like that, those are things that we can bring to, you know, attention during film time. Hey, get your head up. You know, we don't want you hurt. We want you doing things correctly. You know, we'll stress that all the time. It's just a point of emphasis within the staff and what we do.
Well, Coach Corey Brandt, I'm glad you could join us for the program today. And how do the Nighthawks look this year? How's the team?
We'll find out. Brand new. There you go.
Very good.
We're going to have fun anyway. I don't know how it will be, but we're going to have a good time.
Okay. Well, Coach Corey Brandt, the head high school football coach for Boyden Hole, Rock Valley in Northwest Iowa, is using an iPad app for assessing concussion injuries. Corey Brandt, thanks for being on the program today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it, Ben.
Thank you. I want to introduce my next guest is Dr. Andrew Peterson, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Director of the Sports Concussion Clinic at the University of Iowa. He also serves as a team physician for the University of Iowa Hawkeyes, wrestling, and track and field. Dr. Andrew Peterson, thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Glad to have you. And we want to hear from listeners as well. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. How dangerous are high school sports? What injuries are you worried about? 1-866-780-9100. Email river2river at iowapublicradio.org. Post on our Facebook page. Send a tweet at IPR Talk. Well, Dr. Andrew Peterson, why don't we get right to the heart of the matter, the basics here. What exactly is a concussion?
Yeah, so a concussion is a disturbance of the brain that's caused by trauma, and it's a mild traumatic brain injury. It's a subtype of mild traumatic brain injury. People that are involved in like motor vehicle collisions or have more severe types of brain injuries commonly have more moderate or severe types of brain injuries, but concussions by definition are a subset of mild traumatic brain injury. And what happens is there's mechanical disruption to the axonal cells. So the membranes of the neurons themselves get damaged when someone has a blow to the head. And that causes some change in the ions, especially potassium and calcium, that normally stabilize that membrane. And some of the excitatory neurotransmitters start to leak out and stimulate cells that are in the vicinity. And then the cells themselves have to do a bunch of work to try to return to their normal homeostatic state. So they're trying to get their ions back where they should be. And this creates kind of an energy imbalance that makes the cells not work very well. So not only are they releasing transmitters that irritate and change the function of the cells in the vicinity, they're also not working very well because they don't have enough energy at the mitochondrial level, at the machinery of the cell level, to do their jobs.
So this, what you're describing, this isn't just a bruise. This is a change. This is an injury to the brain. It's a change in the brain.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a very common misconception, that there's some type of bruising that happens in the brain. But that's actually very rare. So bruising implies some type of bleeding. And the vast majority of the time when someone has a sports-related head injury, there's no bleeding at all. If you have bleeding in your brain, that's a more severe type of brain injury. But with sport-related concussion in particular, there's very rarely any bleeding at all. It's really at the biomechanical and biochemical level of the neurons.
Well, what injuries cause a concussion? What's happening with an athlete that makes that injury happen?
Yeah, it's typically direct. Collision. So especially a collision to the head tends to be the ones that cause most of the concussions, although there can be transmitted blows as well. So I'll see athletes every now and then that are hit hard in the chest or in the back, and they have some transmitted forces that cause a concussion. And also rotational forces can cause concussions as well. So you don't have to necessarily get hit that hard directly in the head if you have a hard rotational component of the impact.
Well, with this change of the brain and injury to the brain, how long does it take to heal, and what's happening?
Right. So this is another common misconception. Most people heal very, very quickly. So the vast majority of concussions, 95% plus, are back to normal within 8 days. So the vast majority heal very quickly, but there are a subset of people that seem to take longer to recover.
And why is it?
Yeah, so that's a good question. There are certain genetics that we think might play a role. There's a particular set of genes called the apolipoprotein E genes that seem to increase your risk of having a concussion and increase your chances of having a more severe type of injury, an injury that lasts longer and has more severe symptoms. Also, for some reason, and we're not sure exactly why, women tend to have more severe and more prolonged symptoms than men do.
Well, what types of things, are people just healing from this injury on their own, or what treatment is involved?
Yeah, so most people heal on their own. By far the most important thing over the short term is rest. So I always tell people to rest and recover as much as they can in the first 24, 48 hours after the injury. There's one particular type of therapy called cocooning that I use for illustrative purposes rather than doing, where kids who are concussed in, say, a Friday night football game will go home and spend the weekend in a dark room. So no telephone, no text messaging, no computers, no video games, and they just shut it all down for the weekend. You know, they can get up to go to the bathroom, but that's about it. And I don't go that far with athletes, but I tell them to minimize everything they can. I tell them to think about everything they're doing and to think, can I put this off? Can I do this later? Is this something that I really have to do now? And to just take as much time to rest and recover as best they can over the short term. After that short term, there's other things that can be done. So certain people need vestibular rehab, for example. Some people need physical therapy for either their neck or to start to tolerate physical activity. Some people need neuro-ophthalmologic rehab, other types of rehabilitation treatments.
Well, so you mentioned that a concussion injury can heal relatively quickly, but having repetitive, having multiple concussions, how does that change the situation?
Yeah, there's two issues there. So the first issue is, does having one concussion increase your risk of having another? And the answer is yes. So we've known this since about 2001. Kevin Guskowitz at North Carolina did some great work showing that if you had one concussion, you had about a 40% increased risk of having a second. And if you had a second concussion, you had about a 250% increased risk of having a third. And if you had three or more concussions, it was about 300% increased risk of having more concussions in your life. So having had a concussion increases your risk of having more concussions. Now, the big question is that there something about having a concussion that increases your risk, or is it the more vulnerable brains that are getting concussed in the first place? Is it something about the athlete or about the individual that makes their brain more susceptible or more prone to the injury in the first place? And are those people more likely to get concussions down the road? Or is the concussion causing permanent harm that causes more long-term effects?
Or as we heard from the coach Corey Brandt earlier, trying to prevent concussions involves certain form, at least in football, especially involves certain form. And maybe if a person has bad form, maybe that might be another reason they'd be more likely to get another concussion.
Yeah, exactly. You know, people do a lot of different things with equipment and devices, and none of those have really been ever shown to work. Tim McGuine just published a fantastic study showing that the type of football helmet doesn't make any difference. So how old the helmet is, what type of helmet they have, whether it's a cheap helmet, whether it's an expensive helmet. It doesn't make any difference in terms of concussion risk. We've known for a long time that these caps that you put on helmets that people are marketing to prevent concussions don't work. We've known that mouth guards don't work. But what we do know works is technique modification. So a good example of this is the NFL, right? In 2011, they changed their kickoff rules so that they went from having about 2,000 kickoff returns in a season to only having about 1,300 kickoff returns in a season. And that decreased their number of concussions by about half on the kickoff, which is the most dangerous part of the game.
Well, let's hear from some of our listeners now. You can call us at 1-866-780-9100. How dangerous are high school sports? What are your questions about injuries in high school sports? 1-866-780-9100. Let's see if we can go to Maria in Iowa City. Maria.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I've had numerous blows to the head over my lifetime, starting in childhood. And what my neurologists have told me is that the eye tissue is the fastest to heal and the brain tissue is the slowest to heal. And it's actually the healing process that can cause the problems, such as epilepsy. It's the coup and contre-coup, which is, in French, the blow and the counter-blow of the brain bouncing around inside the skull. The scar tissue actually interrupts the synapses of the brain and causes a firing in the brain, which can be like an electrical storm, and that's what can cause epilepsy, including grand mal epilepsy. And that's when you can have seizures occur, and that actually takes 2 years often to occur because the brain is the slowest tissue of the body to heal. And so... some of what I'm hearing from your guest is the opposite of what I've been told by my neurologist.
And our guest, Dr. Andrew Peterson, not a neurologist, but what is your take on that, Andrew?
Yeah,
Peterson?
So she's talking about a more severe type of brain injury. So moderate and severe traumatic brain injury does tend to have more long-term effects. And it's different than concussion, which is by definition a mild traumatic brain injury. So the coup-contra-coup injuries are referring specifically to types of bleeding patterns that you see. And if you have any bleeding in the brain, it's different than what we see in concussion. So in concussion, we see problems with shear forces rather than these direct traumatic forces like the caller is talking about. And if you do have bleeding in the brain, or if you have a more severe type of brain injury called diffuse axonal injury, which is what she's describing, it's very common to have very slow neurologic recovery, and there are real long-term sequelae of that. I agree with everything she said, but we're talking about two different types of brain injuries.
Maria, sorry to hear about your injuries, and good luck to you. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Andrew Peterson, again, Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Director of the Sports Concussion Clinic at the University of Iowa. In the past few years, there's been some changes, some laws passed in a number of states, including Iowa, that are aimed at protecting student-athletes from concussions. Can you talk briefly about how that came about and what were the effects?
Yeah, so the first one of those laws in the country was the Lystead Law in Washington State, named after Zachary Lystead. Stan Herring at the University of Washington was the main driving force behind that. And most states now have some version of the Lystead Law. The Iowa Law is a near duplicate of the Lystead Law. And so what the Iowa Law includes is a preamble of kind of guiding principles, talks about concussions being a problem, that we should try to do things to protect young athletes from concussions. The second part of it is a directive to give a concussion fact sheet to high school-aged athletes. So kids who are playing high school football, it's Coach Brandt's kids, they need to take a form home before the season, and they and their parents need to sign it and say that they know about what a concussion is. And the third part is another part that Coach Brandt talked about, and that's that if a coach or official recognizes signs or symptoms of a concussion or they're suspicious that one of their players may have sustained a concussion, they need to remove them from that contest or that practice and that they can't return to play until they've been cleared by a licensed medical provider who is well-trained in concussion management. And that licensed healthcare provider can be a lot of different types of providers. It could be a physician, it can be a physician's assistant, it can be a chiropractor, it can be a nurse practitioner, a nurse, a physical therapist, certified athletic trainer. But they have to be people who really know concussions and who are trained in the evaluation and management of concussions.
Well, and are there areas of concussion injuries that is there more research that needs to be done? What still do we need to know about concussion injuries?
Yeah, so the huge question with concussions right now is, what are the long-term effects of having multiple concussions? I think everyone is starting to agree that it's not good, but what exactly that means, it's hard to know. All we can really say with certainty at this point is that more concussions is worse than having fewer concussions. That's all you can really say. We're starting to learn more and more, especially from the brain pathology of former NFL players, that there's a real risk of having multiple head injuries in terms of developing this long-term problem called chronic traumatic encephalopathy or tau encephalopathy, where you get real types of scarring on the brain. And it's fortunately a very rare problem, but we really don't know how many concussions someone can tolerate, what individual factors or genetic factors might contribute to this, and how we might be able to prevent it. So that's the big question right now with concussion management, is how do we identify people that are at risk for having long-term sequelae, and how do we prevent that from happening?
And you are the team physician for the University of Iowa Hawkeyes wrestling and track and field teams that see concussions in those sports too?
Yeah, and I direct our sport concussion clinic, so I see the bulk of the concussions that happen in all of our athletes in all of our sports. I form our concussion policy every year, and we talk about most of the concussions that happen in our athletes. We see a lot of concussions. We see about the same number of concussions as what's been published in the literature. So we see about the same rate as what other people have reported.
Dr. Andrew Peterson, thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Peterson is Assistant Professor of Pediatrics and Director of the Sports Concussion Clinic at the University of Iowa. He also serves as the team physician for the Iowa Hawkeyes wrestling and track and field. That's it for our program today. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Sarah Bowden. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Dennis Reese, Rob Dillard, and Sean McLean. We welcome your comments and questions about the program. Contact us by email rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Ben Stanton, and for Ben Kiefer, River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.